Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Fluoride has been added to most municipal drinking water supplies for over 80 years. In fact, we can pinpoint the exact date, January 25th, 1945. That was the day that Grand Rapids, Michigan, added fluoride to their water based on research showing that fluoride helps prevent tooth decay. Over the years, that practice spread. Today, over 72% of water systems in this country provide fluoridated water, reaching more than half the population. It's a practice largely considered groundbreaking and one that is credited with transforming preventative dentistry. But now, that trend may be slowly reversing. Some cities have begun to remove fluoride from the water, including parts of Union County, North Carolina, and Lincoln County. Opponents point to alleged detrimental effects. They say fluoride works just as well and may be safer when used topically. And they point to the ubiquity of products that allow for just that, toothpastes and mouthwashes. But the American Dental Association is still solidly behind fluoridation as a safe, effective, and inexpensive way to prevent tooth decay for people of all ages. It's also a means of offering protection against cavities to children who may not have access to dental hygiene products containing fluoride. Today, we look at the pros and cons, at the science behind fluoridation, and the political forces working against it. We're joined by two pediatric dentists. Dr. Scott Goodman has practiced in Charlotte for decades and is a diplomat for the American Board of Pediatric Dentistry. Dr. Tim Wright is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill, a pediatric dentist and editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Dental Association. And Sarah Israelson Hartley is a freelance journalist based in Raleigh who writes about policy and about public health problems and solutions. She has written extensively on fluoridation. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. And Dr. Goodman, I'm going to start with you because we're doing this program in part because of moves here and elsewhere to end fluoridation of the water supplies, and also in part because you wrote us about this from a professional point of view, to express your alarm at this trend, driven, you say, by uninformed laypeople, legislators, and policymakers. Given the long and extensive use of fluoride and its track record of success, and the seeming lack of a lot of problems associated with it, and the fact that the CDC has characterized water fluoridation as one of the 20th century's 10 greatest public health achievements, what is driving this push against it?
All I can say is, after speaking to politicians and policymakers on that, it seems like, I don't know why there isn't this belief in true science. It seems like they'll take an article that says one thing that really isn't a well done research, and they'll run with that versus not looking at the hundreds and hundreds of research that's been done, especially since water fluoridation started in the 40s and 50s. There was multiple studies looking at differences in cancer rates and growth and different areas that was done in the 40s and 50s, because they had cities that would have fluoridated water and cities that didn't, and they found no differences at that time.
Dr. Wright, the state of Utah banned fluoride in its water in March of this year. Florida followed suit several months later, and that is now being considered in Montana, North Dakota, South Carolina, and certain places in this state. And last year, Now Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. posted on X that the Trump administration would, quote, advise all U.S. water systems to remove fluoride from public water. And he called fluoride an industrial waste. But he's also skeptical of vaccines, and he's leveled accusations about the adverse health impacts of vaccines, which are similar to what he says about the impact of fluoride. He's also known to clasp onto conspiracy theories. Despite that, do suspicions about fluoride deserve investigation, or is this, in your mind, settled science?
Well, I'm a pretty inquisitive kind of a person. My dad was a scientist, and he said, you should challenge everything. So get your data and get your information. Now, having said that, I think that we have looked at this in depth over decades of time in all kinds of manners, in animal studies, human studies, big epidemiological studies, such as Scott was alluding to, where people talked about, oh, there's an increase in Down syndrome, there's an increase in osteosarcoma, there's an increase in this disease, or and now the decrease in IQ or increase in ADHD. These have been looked at very thoroughly across the country and across the globe. Actually, there's international studies. 23 other countries in the world have fluoridated, added industrial waste. You brought that up. You frequently see the anti-fluoride people say it's rat poison. It was used as rat poison. Also not true. And it's not an industrial waste. It does come from mining process because that's where it resides. It's in the earth. So it's not an unnatural thing. It's 13th most common element in the earth's crust. So, these are things that people latch onto, and they're trying to make a point. They're trying to tell a story against it. And why do they do that? Because they're passionate about it. I think Robert Kennedy is very passionate about this, but I think he's ill-informed, and he's the convergence of evidence. And that's what you're looking at, is Scott pointed out, people latch onto one study and they'll say, oh, this shows that there was in Canada, there was a study and it showed a 1-point drop in males and nobody else. And they'll latch onto that and they'll cite that. But if you look at the convergence of hundreds of articles and the synthesis of those, what is that? How close does that get you to true, that actual truth? And the evidence is clear that there's not evidence of any harm at the levels that they're currently used. At high levels, there are. But at the levels that we currently recommend, and even well below anything that would show toxic levels. So that's where we are.
So, Scott, you and Tim Wright are both pediatric dentists, and you have been practicing in this area in Charlotte for decades, have had a practice going for a long time. In your time treating pediatric patients, have you witnessed ever medical conditions or problems that have arisen that you can directly connect to the fluoridation of the water, or have you had parents express concerns about fluoride in the water?
To the first question is no. To the second question is yes. And I think it's basically passing information on. And when you do, and what's interesting you asked that, Mike, since this has come up, I've asked probably the last 30 or 40 parents in the practice about, do you have any concerns about fluoride? It's done. And again, I have a very captive audience, and all of them have said, no, I listen to you. You are the experts. We are very happy what's going on.
Same question.
I can just finish one thing, if that's okay.
Sure.
Is that I've worked in non-fluoridated areas. I worked in gas study in Shelby before I came to Charlotte. I've seen the difference between non-fluoridated areas or fluoride wells that don't have significant fluoride in them. And there are a few that do in this area. And the difference when we see the decay rate, and also how quickly the decay can go in primary teeth, because the back teeth are so thin, the enamel, that it makes a huge difference on that, of what happens to children, especially lower socioeconomic children that have a higher rate of decay for a number of reasons.
So, Tim Wright, same question to you. As a practicing dentist, a pediatric dentist, have you seen anything in patients that would be a medical condition or problem that you could directly connect to fluoride in the water?
Well, only the negative side, the flip side of that is if they don't have fluoride in the water, as we just pointed out, we see a lot of decay in kids with rampant caries, which is the most common disease in America, and the most common chronic disease that we have. And to the point about, Dr. Scott was talking about people and their attitudes about this. Yes, we are seeing an uptick in concern of parents, even practitioners, because they see all this in the media. And why is that? Well, studies have shown that where do people get their information, and what do they trust? So Dr. Goodman is, he's a respected pediatric dentist, and people trust his knowledge and his wisdom. And if you look at the studies, they get it from healthcare providers. They have previously gotten it from the United States government to say this is an effective and safe thing. Now they're not. And that makes people pause and said, maybe I shouldn't have fluoride in my water. Maybe I shouldn't get a vaccine. And so that's a huge shift in how people are looking at this. And is part of the reason I think that we're seeing, not I think, I mean, that is part of the reason that we're seeing this uptick of concern in both practitioners and with the population in general, I think.
Sarah Israelson-Hartley is with us. She's a freelance journalist who writes about policy and medical issues, and she's written extensively on fluoridation of the water. And I'm going to turn to you for a little history lesson, Sarah. Fluoridation began in 1945, as I said, in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And Charlotte, interestingly enough, was one of the first cities in the Carolinas to fluoridate their municipal water supply just 4 years later in 1949. Why? Where did the idea that fluoridation of the water would be good to prevent tooth decay come from?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, fluoride, as has been mentioned, is naturally occurring, comes from the earth. And early in the 1900s, you had dentists that were sort of noticing different things happening with different populations. There was a dentist named Dr. Frederick McKay who set up shop in Colorado, went there, from the East Coast, noticed that a lot of his patients had very odd staining on their teeth. It almost looked like their teeth were covered in chocolate. And they couldn't quite figure out what was causing this mottling on their teeth. Eventually, over time, and with multiple researchers, traced it to fluoride, and this was very high levels of fluoride that was in the water. And so they worked and tried
Naturally,
to figure out how to
occurring
naturally
fluoride.
occurring. Yeah,
Right.
just naturally occurring in the water. And so as they worked, they wanted to try to find a way, because they noticed a lot of the teeth were also pretty strong and resistant to cavities. And so they wanted to find where's the optimal level where we can protect teeth, but not have what looks like chocolate on our teeth. And so, in the 30s and 40s, started to really hone in on some levels that would prevent that staining, but offer some protection. And this was really, great news in the 1930s and 40s. You had a lot of men who were excluded from serving in the war because they were missing teeth. They had a lot of dental problems, which caused their teeth to, fall out or be removed. And that was part of one of the requirements for service was that you had functioning teeth so you could eat and get proper nutrition. And so scientists and researchers really saw this as a good way to increase the number of men that were available to serve. And so thought if we can add this to the water, we can get this to more people and we can get sort of this preventative, the cavity protection to more people. And so like then you said that led to trying this in Grand Rapids in 1945.
Yeah, that was 44 years after that dentist in Colorado had questions about why people coming to his practice had chocolate-covered teeth or teeth that looked like that in 1901. Are the beneficial aspects, Dr. Wright, of fluoridating the water beyond dispute, or are there some doubts by some professionals about the efficacy of this practice? And I have 30 seconds.
There may be some doubts but from some people, but again, if you look at the convergence of the evidence from decades and decades in clinical studies, the evidence is pretty clear that fluorides, whether it's community water fluoridation or toothpaste or any of the others, is the most effective caries-fighting agent that we have, bar none. So the evidence is clear, and in fact, there are no substitutes that come close to having the effectiveness that fluorides do, in regardless of what delivery system that you would apply.
And we're going to talk
So,
about those delivery systems and what they might mean and what the absence of fluoride in the water might mean in an age where fluoride is in most brands of toothpaste. But we'll talk about that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about water fluoridation, something that's been going on for over 80 years in much of the country, starting in 1945 in Grand Rapids, Michigan, 1949 here in Charlotte. But there are those now pushing back on water fluoridation, and we're going to continue exploring why and the science behind both the good and the bad, if there is a bad. Sarah Israelson Hartley is with us. She's a freelance journalist who's written extensively about this. Dr. Scott Goodman is a pediatric dentist practicing here in Charlotte, and Dr. Tim Wright's a pediatric dentist and professor of dentistry and the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Dental Association. He's at UNC Chapel Hill. Scott Goodman, do we know how much fluoride is put into Charlotte's drinking water? Or is there a nationwide magic ratio of fluoride to X number of gallons of water?
Well, originally it was when A. Treadley Dean recommended the fluoride levels for to get the greatest benefit from the decay with the less chance of the side effects of mild fluorosis, which is a white spot in the teeth. It was one part per million. And now the recommendations later has been most fluoridation water is going to be down to 0.7 parts per million on it, which like if you look at that is basically, if you're looking at the 1 milligram of fluoride a day to drink, that's about 6 glasses of water a day. If everyone drank that, that would be the, that would be the level that would be recommended from H. Treadley Dean back in 1945 when they did the recommendations for water fluoridation. Charlotte's water fluoridation, I just got it the other day, it came out. It's 0.68 parts per million for the city of Charlotte.
So you mentioned that particularly the back teeth, the primary teeth, baby teeth is what we used to call them, that fall out and are replaced by your permanent teeth, they're particularly soft. Are the benefits of fluoride in the water, the benefits of fluoride in toothpaste for that matter, are they primarily aimed at children, or do adults get something out of having water fluoridation, Dr. Goodman?
Adults definitely do. Their studies were done in the 70s that showed a 30-40% reduction in decay from fluoridated water or any type of topical. The effect, the systemic effect is when the enamel's forming in children, which on the teeth, the primary teeth, usually it's just after birth until about age 7 to 8, except for our wisdom teeth. So that's the great systemic effect, which gets into the inorganic chemistry of fluoride replacing the hydroxy ion. I won't go into the whole explanation of that, but most of the effect is topical because it has an effect on what we call demineralization and remineralization of the enamel. When we get decay, it isn't, you eat something, you get a cavity, it gets bigger and bigger. It's a chemical equation in that it goes back and forth. The teeth demineralize, they remineralize. It relates to what we eat. It relates to also how often we eat. It relates to the bacteria in our mouth. Do they produce enough acid, or as I say to children in my practice, so they pee pee on our teeth, and how much they do, that determines how our decay rate. And the idea for fluoride, it will tend to cause more remineralization than demineralization, and also affects the bacteria in the mouth. And probably Dr. Wright can explain it better than I can.
Okay, well, Dr. Wright, actually, I want a different explanation. Why do we need fluoride in the water in 2025, when almost every brand of toothpaste and every mouthwash contains fluoride? And I understand, and maybe the difference is that the topical application isn't as effective, but why do we need it in the water in this century?
Great question. I have an answer for that. So Scott alluded to this during development. So what happens when you consume fluoride? It's taken up in your body. In the stomach, most of it goes into your bloodstream. And then what happens to it? If you're a growing child, about 80% of it is deposited in the mineralizing tissues, the growing bones and teeth in your body. That's where it goes. The rest, most of the rest is excreted through your kidneys. In an adult, it's about 50%. So during development of the dentition, the teeth are mineralizing and hardening. The fluoride is actually taken up in those teeth, and that makes them more resistant to decay. Because if you have more fluoride in the enamel, it's going to be less, it'll be more acid resistant. So it's less likely to develop decay. So there are different mechanisms for fluoride. That is unique. The systemic from water fluoridation, consuming it and getting that little bit is helpful in that. And it continues to have a topical effect, both when you consume it, it's washing across your teeth, but it also, a little bit of it is secreted back out in your saliva. And that continues to allow the fluoride ion to be available to then help remineralize. And so it's a multi, it's not one thing. And toothpaste is a little bit different because that's straight up topical, except for the little bit that you're going to ingest, you're going to consume a little bit of it. So there, but there's some different mechanisms by how it works.
So, would you consider internalization of fluoride through drinking water versus topical application through toothpaste? Would you consider one of those methods superior to the other?
I don't think of them as superior. If you look at the actual, the clinical studies, how much bang for your buck do you get between the two of them? If you're going to look at it that way, both of them are highly effective. And the benefit is, if you have both, you're going to have more resistance from adding the, if you add toothpaste on top of the water fluoridation, it doesn't double the benefit, but you definitely not crank it up a notch. And given that this is such a ubiquitous disease in the population, the cost, dentistry is $180 billion enterprise in the United States. So if you knock down caries 10%, and there was a recent study published in JAMA on this, what's going to happen when we take fluoride out, you're talking billions of dollars. So it's a huge financial, and not only that, but the health of the individuals that have toothaches end up in emergency departments, and occasionally people die from abscessed teeth. So that's a little bit of a long answer, but there you go.
Okay, Sarah, we're only doing this program because not everybody agrees with these two doctors. Some people are very suspicious of and want fluoride out of the water. And you've written extensively about a University of North Carolina study being conducted in Kinston to determine whether naturally fluoridated water is statistically better at preventing cavities in young children than water without fluoride. Kinston has never had fluoridated water, which makes them, I guess, one of the perfect spots to conduct this test. Do they have a higher incidence of cavities there?
I don't know that it's higher than any other spot that, might have similar circumstances, but I think what Dr. Gary Slade at UNC was interested in studying is, can we really pinpoint that it's the fluoride in the water that's making a difference? And he was really interested in doing this randomized controlled trial, for which he believes this is the first of its kind. There has been a lot of research into fluoride, but not usually in a randomized control sort of setting. That's a difficult trial to do. It's expensive. You have to be very careful about making sure that you have your control group and your test group. And so he's doing this, and he's doing it with bottled water, so he can control which families receive the fluoridated water, which families receive the non-fluoridated water, and then really evaluating the effectiveness of the fluoride in the water on the children's
I want
teeth.
to come back to something you just said, and you write about in that article, and it was kind of shocking to me because this is 2025, and Dr. Gary Slade, professor of dentistry at UNC Chapel Hill, is running what he believes to be the first ever randomized trial of fluoride in drinking water. It's been in our water for 80 years. How can this be the first trial?
That's a good question. One little specific, this is with bottled water. There's room for someone somewhere to have maybe done this. Slade does believe this is the first, but a lot of what those I spoke with were concerned about it, that we have had a lot of studies, but not to sort of the gold standard level of a randomized controlled trial. And so Slade was, of course, interested in doing this as a dentist himself and as a professor of preventative dentistry. Was very
So
interested in having this
Tim
question
Wright,
answered.
he's a colleague of yours at UNC Chapel Hill, and what can you tell us about this study? Why is there a need for it now? Don't we already know the answer to this study? Because just anecdotally, don't we already know the answer?
Well, I think that people have that are concerned about fluoride and whether it's effective or not effective point to there's no randomized control trials. And I'm not aware of any either that have ever been done. And the reason they haven't been done is because the way that the studies were designed was community-based, because it's difficult to control water sources. So you can't put people, it's like this tap has water, fluoridated water, and the next door neighbors don't, and you would randomize that. Very difficult to do. But Dr. Slade is actually taking water out of the same river. In one area, it's naturally fluoridated to a pretty optimal level, and the other, it has very low levels. Most water has some fluoride in it naturally occurring. So that was the study design. And so he did this in response to the continued claims that, well, you don't even have a randomized controlled trial, which is the gold standard, as Sarah just pointed out, for evidence.
So this study's been going on for a couple of years, and it will be a couple of more years, Sarah, I understand, before they can come up with an analysis of their results and publish them. When do they anticipate being able to do so? And will that be the study that puts the kibosh on all the naysayers?
Your first question, probably 4 or 5 years. It will be a while. You know, we have to wait till these children grow up and study the effects on their teeth as they develop and fall out and get new teeth. And then will this sort of answer the question and solve it once and for all? I don't think so. This study cannot comment at all on any sort of concerns about IQ impacts on children. The study is not addressing that. It was not set up to address that. This is only looking at, you know, the rates of cavities in children's teeth. So as the concerns become raised that fluoridated water does have some impact on children's neurological development, that question is still outstanding. And to date, the US has no studies looking at the neurological effects on children. All of those studies are done outside of the United States. So there's still room to keep asking these questions, and this study will not answer all of
And
them.
what of the studies, because that's important. It's not just the fact that fluoride maybe have some detrimental effect on your teeth, the coloration of your teeth if you have ingest too much fluoride. It's also that there are suspicions that the fluoridation of the water does lower your IQ by a couple of points, maybe not enough to be noticeable, but it does, according to some. According to some, it also may be leading to ADHD and other things that people who are vaccine skeptics also allege of vaccines. What are these European studies or studies in other countries showing us about neurological effects of fluoridation?
Yeah. And those a lot of those studies that were done outside the country were reviewed by the National Toxicology Program, and that's a federal agency that's actually headquartered here in the Triangle. And they reviewed more than 100 studies and were moderately confident that exposure to fluoride at levels above 1.5, again, we talked about current water being at 0.7, so this is double that amount, that is associated with slightly lower IQ levels in children. And so
Isn't
what that
that,
means is,
would that be reason enough to stop it?
For some people, that's reason enough to be very cautious about continuing and to continue to ask questions. Not necessarily because the fluoride level of 0.7 is problematic, but there's concern that children, especially children, young children, may be getting fluoride from other, they are getting fluoride from other sources. We've mentioned the toothpaste, it's in a lot of the foods we eat. A lot of the beverages, if they're being made with fluoridated water, it then becomes a little bit difficult to sort of calculate the cumulative impact on a child if they're receiving fluoridated water plus food, beverages, toothpaste. Then you're getting closer to that, maybe that 1.5 or maybe even above that 1.5. And that's where some of the concerns come in, is that cumulatively, children may be getting more.
And maybe I'm not sure which of the our medical professionals here can answer this question because their expertise is dentistry and perhaps not other aspects of medicine. But could it be argued that some children may be more susceptible to whatever the negative impact of fluoride may be than others? In other words, maybe fluoride is great for 90% of the kids, but there's that 10% that might be more apt to have a problem surface. I'm not sure which one of you to ask. I'll ask Dr. Wright. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So, what do we know, the real science behind that question? One of them is that we're not all created equal. We don't metabolize fluoride equally. Our kidneys don't function the same. The pH of our serum is not the same, or urine, things that are involved in the metabolism and uptake of fluoride. So, but when you look at, and there have been studies done on serum levels and urine levels, if you use a toothpaste, a fluoridated toothpaste, if you drink fluoridated water is so low, it doesn't usually even create a blip on the radar screen in the serum levels. And, unless again you drank an awful lot of water, and most people don't drink that much water these days. I mean, that's a problem in and of itself. And many don't trust the water sources. Flint, Michigan, after Flint, a lot of people went to bottled water. Most of that is being filtered and has low levels of fluoride in there, or none, depending on how they process it. So the answer to your question is, I don't think could there be some very small subset of people that might have be sense more sensitive than others? Possibly. But the evidence from when you look at the IQs, IQs have gone up consistently in the United States since the 1940s in water fluoridation. They haven't gone down. If you compare, and there have been studies across countries where they compare fluoridated communities and non-fluoridated communities, the IQs they're similar. In some cases, they're actually higher in the fluoridated areas. Sweden did a study across the whole country and looked at the different levels and looked at ADHD, neurobehavioral, other aspects, autism. They looked at medications for ADHD, and they found no association between fluoride levels and those kind of neurobehavioral or any other medical. So there's a lot of data out there to suggest. So I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's not probable based on the evidence that we have at hand.
Dr. Goodman, there are other concerns other than neurological concerns. There have also been reports that long-term excessive fluoride intake may lead to joint pain and bone thickening. Some studies suggest thyroid issues may result from excess fluoride, may lead to imbalances in calcium metabolism. And there's some concerns about fluoride's impact, as we said, on neurological development as well. What's your response to that? Is the trade-off worth it?
Well, when you say about trade-off, I'm going to go back to what Tim was saying about the Swedish study. When you look at Scandinavian studies, they're great because they follow people for years and years and years and years. And the study he's talking about, basically, they looked at IQ and different things on children from 7 to 13 years old and followed them to the age of 38. And they found no difference at all for IQ, for any situation of IQ or any neurological problems at all. To go back to your question, there will be an increase in fluoride in the bone as we age, and that it's taken in. It won't affect, obviously, the oral environment, the teeth themselves, except topically. And it actually has been used for treatment to increase bone density as we get older. To answer your question, I don't have any research and known anything, any problems later that have been well-controlled studies to look at those aspects you asked about.
I know that Dr. Wright wants to chime in, but we don't have time, so we'll get your response to that when we come back, because you are the editor-in-chief of the American Dental Association, and I'm curious where they come down on all this. And we'll talk about medical freedom, the concept that you shouldn't force me to take a substance that I don't want to take, and if it's in the water, you're making me take it. We'll talk about that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. We're talking about fluoridation of water to strengthen teeth and the pushback against it, which is a relatively new thing. It's in the last couple of years. Dr. Scott Goodman gave us the idea. He's a pediatric dentist here in Charlotte. Dr. Tim Wright's with us, also a pediatric dentist, professor of dentistry, and also the editor at UNC Chapel Hill, and also the editor-in-chief of the American Dental Association Journal. And Sarah Israelson Hartley is a freelance journalist who has written on this and other medical policy topics. Before we move on to medical freedom, Dr. Wright, I know that you wanted to comment on what we were talking about before. Those are the other perhaps bad side effects of fluoride in the water, including joint pain and bone thickening, etc.
Right. So specifically around the skeletal issue. So I mentioned earlier that fluoride, when you consume it, it goes into the bloodstream. A good portion of it will be rapidly uptaken. And most of it's deposited in the skeleton, less in an adult than in a growing child. The EPA recommendations at this point, if you have over 2 parts per million, they have a warning on that as far as drinking water, that they would recommend not to drink that water, or you should be aware that it could cause tooth problems primarily. When at 4 parts per million, they recommend that that water not be considered potable, that you should not drink it. And the reason is that they've, again, shown through epidemiological studies that 4.5 that you have increased risk. Predominantly postmenopausal osteoporotic women will have increased risk of bone fractures. So we know that at higher levels, there are deleterious effects. And so my point to this is going to be a more global one, and that is concentration matters. So when people talk about fluoride, it's not fluoride, it's how much fluoride. And so the levels that we use in community water fluoridation are extremely low, but shown to be effective. And so when you're looking at fluorides, that needs to be considered in the overall health aspects because concentration matters.
But Sarah, we've been talking about how in municipal water supplies, the amount of fluoride in the water is very small and almost not measurable. But there are other sources of fluoride that people come in contact with through food and other forms of drink and toothpastes and mouthwashes. Given the concerns that have been expressed by some over fluoridation and the fact that there have been no randomized trials of fluoride, is that an argument for erring on the side of caution that we should not force people to ingest a substance that might harm them?
That's a good question, and that's sort of the million-dollar question: is are the benefits, do they outweigh the risks? And I think some that I've talked with would say yes, that we need to be a little bit more cautious, and rather than working to expand fluoride to more communities, we should try to address pockets. If we see there's lots of tooth decay in a community, let's address and get more topical or get more dentists to be available. Try to do other things rather than going for more of a systemic. Let's put this in the water. Let's get it to everyone. So it is very much a balancing act.
This is the medical freedom argument that's also being used by anti-vaxxers and others who don't want to be told what they must do or don't want to be forced to do something because they have no other options because it's in the water, after all. Dr. Goodman, should we be free to make our own medical decisions? Share your thoughts on that.
Well, the thoughts are, if you have water fluoridation, if you don't have water fluoridation, it's much more difficult to have fluoridated water. You'd have to make it yourself, take a 2.2 milligram sodium fluoride tablet and dissolve it in a liter of water. If you do have fluoridated water and don't want it, you can put a reverse osmosis filter on your place that gets your water supply. It costs between $300 and $500. You have to replace the filters every month, but that will take the fluoride out of the water. You could have it in the place you get water, and then use fluoridated water maybe to rinse your mouth out and use it topically. So you can stop it systemically if people don't want to have it.
So, Sarah, you have referenced an organization in your articles called the Fluoride Action Network. They say that their mission is to broaden awareness among citizens, scientists, and policymakers on the toxicity of fluoride compounds. They want to end fluoridation and other, quote, involuntary exposures to fluoride. They have scientists working for them, they have dentists working for them. How influential have they been in this fight against fluoridation?
I think they're definitely one of the leading voices calling for fluoridation in water to cease. I also think it's important to point out that there are sort of different camps. And I think a lot of times in this conversation, those that are opposed to fluoride or have questions are sort of immediately painted as conspiracy theorists, wackos, left, just like whatever side that they're almost to be dismissed for raising these concerns. And in my reporting, it was really interesting that even as early as the 1950s, as scientists are learning more about fluoride and talking about this and adding it to the water supply, that there were still scientists who were encouraged by how fluoride was effective, but were wanting to be a little bit cautious and that maybe we don't have all the answers yet for us to be putting this in the water at mass scale. So I just think that's important to point out that it's to have questions about fluoride and its efficacy and its safety does not immediately translate to someone being completely anti-science or that they also embrace vaccine hesitancy beliefs. But there are plenty of scientists, dentists, reputable people in the field that are studying this and have questions and would like to know more about some of the other effects.
And maybe, Dr. Wright, this is because of the proliferation of social media and the fact that anybody can say anything about anything all the time, everywhere. And the fact that maybe science education in our schools isn't what it used to be or isn't what it should be, but you have scientists and dentists working with you at the American Dental Association. The Fluoride Action Network has scientists and dentists working with them, and yet there are opposing points of view on this, which makes it very confusing for the layperson. Why isn't this settled science after 80 years?
Well, science is never settled. Science is an ongoing iteration of a search for the truth. And, we have different methodologies. We have different questions that we ask along the way, and usually it's iterative. We ask this question, we get this answer. That answer usually leads to 5, 10 more questions. So, again, you're looking at the convergence of the evidence at the time. And evidence changes. The world was flat for a whole long time, and there's still a few people out there that believe that. They had a convention in Raleigh, and 500 people showed up. So, we don't. It's not, and it's not a consensus. Science is not a consensus. It's not like, oh, everybody now agrees. So we'll hold hands and sing kumbaya. That's not science. Science is asking, and many of the I have very good colleagues, good friends who are, question the fluoride. Science behind that, and I respect them for doing that. I think that's a good thing. We should be challenging the science behind that and look at what's good science and then look at the evidence and you weigh that out and then you come up with the best conclusion, the closest we have for truth today.
I just hope that the flat earthers don't fall off. Sarah?
No, I really appreciate what Dr. Wright shared. I think that is true. Science, our understanding does evolve. And what I've noticed in my reporting, I did a lot of reporting during the COVID pandemic, vaccine development, things like that. What I have seen changing is how people may tend to look at scientific facts and really base their identity and their political leaning around a certain fact. And then when that fact changes or evolves or we learn more, it becomes very difficult to then separate who you are or your identity from that changing information. And so that's sort of something that we could keep in mind as people that to separate our identity from information and then be willing and humble to act on information as we learn more and as things change and not have it be such a central tenet of who we are as a person or a political leaning or group membership.
So, Scott Goodman, if people are concerned about being forced to ingest this substance, and there's some indication that perhaps ingesting is better for you or perhaps worse for you, depending upon your point of view, than topical application, you have practiced dentistry for 40 years in fluoridated, as you pointed out, and non-fluoridated communities. You say you have not written a systemic prescription for fluoride in 20 years because of fluoridation of water supplies, but since one-third of Union County has now decided not to fluoridate their water, you would prescribe tablets or drops for children age 2 through 7. Why?
Well, I'm going to go back to that, Mike. I prefer the reason I haven't is I prefer to have my parents I speak to try to get fluoridated water instead. And that I think it's much more effective than doing the tablets. You take the tablets once a day. You do not get the topical effect from tablets like you do like water. So my recommendation, the reason I haven't written them before is people that we tested their wells that didn't have enough fluoride in them, I would recommend they would go to a place, our office, wherever, get a jug, put fluoridated water in it, put it in the refrigerator, and have their children drink that on it.
And I ask you that question because back in April of this year, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said he would direct the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to stop recommending that fluoride be added to the drinking water. And then last month in May, he was back on Capitol Hill in front of the House Appropriations Committee, and Republican Representative Mike Simpson from Idaho, who is a practicing dentist, he's been practicing for 22 years, and he is a proponent of fluoridation. Simpson had just discovered that the FDA was bringing action to remove from the market digestible prescription drug products of fluoride for children. I want to play this. It's a pretty lengthy exchange, but you need to hear both sides of it. So we're going to hear that, and I'll get your reaction to it.
I want to see some of these studies, but it says the best way to prevent cavities in children is by avoiding excessive sugar intake and good dental hygiene, obvious. Then it says, for the same reason that fluoride may kill bacteria on teeth, it may also kill intestinal bacteria important to children's health. I would tell you, you don't prevent cavities by fluoride killing the bacteria in the mouth. What it does is make the enamel more resistant to decay. And I will tell you that if you are successful in banning fluoride, we better put a lot more money into dental education, because we're going to need a whole lot more dentists.
I think that, you know, Marty McCary's concern with ingestible fluoride is that the emerging science shows the benefits to of fluoride to caries and to the cavity prevention comes from topical exposures, rather than it was once thought that it was systemic, that if you ingested it, that the benefit came from that. We now know that virtually all the benefit is from topical, and we can get that through mouthwashes, we can get through fluoridated toothpastes. The National Toxicity Program issued a report in August, a meta-review of all the science that now exists on fluoride, and showed a direct inverse correlation between fluoride exposure, dose-related, and lower IQ.
So let's unpack that in reverse order, and we've talked about some of this already, but have credible, Dr. Goodman, have credible scientific studies shown a correlation between doses of prescription fluoride and lower IQ?
I know of no studies that have shown that. The concern would be at the younger ages of having some type of fluorosis, which is some discoloration of the teeth. That was the reason it was changed to 2 to 3 years of age to get fluoride tablets. And I'm going to go back. If you're in a state like Florida or Utah where there is not going to be any fluoridated water, then I would be prescribing fluoride tablets for children between the age 3 and 6.
Secondly, Representative Simpson took issue with one of the FDA's assertions that, quote, for the same reason fluoride may kill bacteria on teeth, it may kill intestinal bacteria important to children's health. He said that is not how fluoride works. Dr. Wright, if you agree with Simpson, Dr. Simpson, does that call into question the validity of the FDA's premise? And if they don't have that science right, can their recommendations possibly be right?
So he actually referenced who he was talking about, Kennedy did, and talked about McCary, which is a textbook, and so he's got 10 tenets, and one of them was fluoride kills the bacteria, and he's extrapolating. So he's wrong on all of that. In fact, the studies that if you look, there's a recent systematic review in a nutrition journal that shows at less than 2 parts per million, you actually have improved biofilm in the gut, or the microbiome in the gut is actually improved. If you get to very high levels, then you may have deleterious effects. So they're way off on the science, and he's not quoting a scientist. McCary is not, he's not a scientist, and he's not a fluoride expert. So yeah, I think that there's plenty of indication that they are misleading and not following good science.
And this is just one example. Science does change over time, as both of you have pointed out. And scientists do discover things later that may change previous practices or scientific decisions. This is legitimate. This happens in every field of science. So how do we know what we're doing is right at any given moment in time? Is it all a crapshoot?
Well, no, I don't believe so. Again, I think that credible scientists and people who are making decisions related based on that science need to look at what is the convergence of the evidence. You know, what is the at that point in time, the best available evidence we have that's pointing towards this is good, this doesn't have negative effects. And that's the way I think those decisions should be made. And they shouldn't be made based on a textbook and one quote by that's clearly wrong and not a scientist who has a clue about microbiology.
I have less than a minute left. Dr. Goodman, in the note that you wrote prior to this program, which caused us to do this show, you expressed your displeasure over children who are in the lower socioeconomic scale as being hurt by what you call incompetent leaders who are making these decisions, and you are concerned about the probability that dentists will now have to admit and treat more children at Levine's Children's Hospital for severe dental decay and facial abscesses, for which there is currently a 5-month waiting list. If that is accurate, why is that so, we already fluoridate the water, and I have 15 seconds.
Great. I think part of it is that there's a large number of medically compromised children that go through the hospital. We're the only practice. There were three or four of us that would be able to do that. And there's also some concerns with the OR time being able to get these people in. And that's the unfortunate situation at the hospital. Plus, we do not have a full-time pediatric dentist there.
Dr. Scott Goodman is a pediatric dentist practicing in Charlotte. Dr. Tim Wright is also a pediatric dentist at UNC Chapel Hill and editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Dental Association. And Sarah Israelson-Hartley is a freelance journalist. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.